Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, November 26, 2014, as we get ready to break for the Thanksgiving holiday. We learn that the end of the war in Afghanistan, well, it's been postponed for Americans. Who will be the last to die? The voice that Springsteen refers to from a long time ago happened to be the voice of a young John Kerry who had served in Vietnam and came home to oppose that war. It was a moment of courage for John Kerry that we haven't seen repeated in his recent years, and especially as Secretary of State. And he is part of the team, the Obama team, that has decided to sneakily keep troop levels in Afghanistan up and extend the combat mission of those troops at least for another full year. When I say sneakily, that's what really pains me, is that President Obama in the past few weeks signed a secret order. We still haven't seen the details of it, but it essentially states that the mission of the American troops in Afghanistan is not just to protect our facilities and embassies and the Bagram Air Base, not just for counterinsurgency, not just for training Afghan troops. No, we will continue to fight the Taliban. And yesterday, in a story that the New York Times has not bothered to cover so far, it was leaked by Reuters that the troop level most recently announced of 9,800, that's supposed to be the residual force that stays after December 31st of this year. Well, that's going to be increased by at least 1,000. And it might go up from there. There are currently 16,000 American soldiers in uniform and an unknown number of contractors serving in Afghanistan. And I think it's entirely possible that that 16,000 figure will be maintained for another full year. Only I can't tell you for sure because our government is not leveling with us. There are no statements attributed to President Obama about this change in policy that is a break in his promises. It's the latest break in the promises that he has made about Afghanistan. Do a Google search, troop levels in Afghanistan. You will see that over the last 5 years, Obama has been all over the place. He surged, and then he withdrew the surge forces. He threatened to pull out all U.S. troops unless Karzai would agree to a status of forces agreement. He got the sofa and the ottoman. No empire. And there is no price that he has to pay. Republicans have no objection to keeping American troops there forever. And Democrats are silenced because it's Obama who's doing this. And when our so-called paper of record, The Times, doesn't even bother to report this. Well, it shows how little interest and accountability remain for any move the administration decides to make in Afghanistan. And once again, this information is based on selective leaks, calculated leaks from official sources, and those leakers will not face any punishment like Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning. No. Because they are official leakers, and they're allowed to. And so the U.S. will continue to keep troops in the so-called graveyard of empires. And this is seen as some sort of a, you know, we have learned from our failure to leave troops in Iraq. Well, that wasn't the failure. The failure goes back to the Bush surge and the elevation of the forces who now run the Islamic State. And then the selection by the U.S. of the Shiite Maliki government that marginalized Sunnis, and they morphed into this deadly threat, as we are told, that we must now confront. Well, liberals like me shuddered when I read the news this morning that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at the age of 81, is in the hospital after undergoing a heart procedure this morning. She was working out with her trainer last night when she experienced discomfort, went to the hospital, and they went into her heart and did something. And I want that heart to keep ticking for a long, long time. Ginsburg is the most liberal justice on the Supreme Court. And when you look back, you know, she was appointed by Bill Clinton, one of the most liberal things he did as president. And that happened in 1993 after a 26-year gap. During those 26 years, no Democrats got to appoint Supreme Court justices. And the last real liberal before Ginsburg was Thurgood Marshall, who went on the court in 1967. And we need Ginsburg desperately. I feel that one of Obama's big failures in the first 2 years when he appointed the only two so far that he's been able to put on the court, Sotomayor and Kagan. And he should have, when he had a Senate majority of Democrats, he should have appointed a full-throated liberal in the vein of Ginsburg or Marshall. And instead, we got these fairly safe, pro-corporate, pro-government, and they're females, and Sotomayor's a Latina. That's all fine. But with the Republican majority in the Senate for the next 2 years, Obama won't even attempt to put a real liberal on the court. And when you look at all these conservatives, particularly the young ones like Alito and Roberts, who are going to be there for another 30 or 40 years, it's really a huge missed opportunity. And when you think about how Bush got Alito and Roberts confirmed at a time when Democrats controlled the Senate, and we even saw, you know, Bush prevail when Democrats didn't control the Senate. The Republicans play a good opposition game, whether they're in power or not. And Obama hasn't shown any risk-taking, any willingness to take risk in his appointments that require Senate confirmation. And it's pretty well a foregone conclusion that he will not fight for a nominee. And that's why they're thinking of rotating Jay Johnson from Homeland Security over to the Pentagon, because they believe he could be easily confirmed. Justice Ginsburg, have a great Thanksgiving. She says she'll be back at the Supreme Court for oral arguments on Monday. The fallout from Ferguson, Missouri, continues to spread across the country. And boy, has there been a lot said on radio, on TV. Great deal of interesting information and analysis on the internet. And I will leave you to the commentary of others on most of these issues. My firm belief is that Darren Wilson should have been indicted, at minimum for manslaughter, and that a court should have been able to review all of the evidence. As I mentioned yesterday, the sequence of events after the altercation between Mike Brown and Officer Wilson in his police vehicle, well, they don't add up. It's conflicting accounts. And we're learning more about the way the grand jury was managed by the prosecutor, that there was no real cross-examination of Officer Wilson's testimony, and that where there were conflicts in the eyewitness accounts, it's clear that the grand jury deferred to the cop, Now, we've seen time and time again the cops will say whatever is necessary and rewrite the events to protect the shooter in this case. But what I would like to comment on today is the role of the media, in particular television, in the violence that we saw on day two. And I certainly understand the anger, the resentment, the smoldering kind of anti-authoritarian attitudes that pervade the African-American communities in this country. But it's really well known, and the Occupy movement provided this model. If you're completely peaceful, television will not cover your protest. And so last night, something I rarely do, at 10 o'clock I flipped on the local news on Channel 2. Channel 2 here is now owned by Fox. It used to be just a Fox affiliate owned by an Atlanta-based conglomerate called Cox. But Cox sold to Fox. All they had to do was change one letter. And now we're getting the full Foxification of news coverage on our local TV station. And what I saw was that the helicopter coverage of protesters who were roaming the streets of Oakland, and they shut down a freeway here for a while, and they shut down a freeway over there for a while, and they were closing some streets. Most of that was nonviolent. But when they went live at 10 o'clock with the helicopter coverage, and anybody who's been in a crowd scene, you know when a helicopter is hovering overhead. The noise is pervasive and unmistakable. And then they use floodlights to light up the sight line of the cameras. And so it's really clear to even the most amateur observer, you know when TV news is actually covering you. So the chopper flies overhead, and all of a sudden a bunch of bad boys in Oaktown broke the windows on a Subway shop and went in and looted it. Now, what the hell do you loot from a Subway sandwich shop? A couple of pounds of turkey? I mean, the cash register's empty after hours. You going to take a box full of single-serving mayonnaise packets? No. The reason they broke into the Subway is because it was there and they were on television. And what was really bizarre, and I watched this carefully and I played it back in slow-mo four times. At one point, the anchorette says, "We're going to go live to Chopper 2 now and look at the scene." And as they did so, the camera angle from Chopper 2 to the ground very briefly showed another helicopter almost hitting Chopper 2. Was only visible for about 2 seconds. But this other chopper comes in from the right-hand side of my screen and blasts through. And certainly I can't give you an accurate estimate, but it looked really damn close to me. And it shows the desperation of the TV news and the companies that they work for. They love riots. They think this is bonanza for ratings. Give me some blood. Give me some fire. Can't you, you know, light a trash can or something? Because, you know, fires really look good on television. And the next day, they make a good front page, full color picture in a newspaper. And on the first night, Monday, when the non-indictment decision was announced, I watched on Fox for a while, and they had a crew on the streets. I think it's Florissant Avenue, the main drag with the season's greetings lit up sign over it. Well, they were roaming around there, and they were providing a stage for a handful of young men who were hooded and running wild to loot a liquor store. And the Fox reporter even tried to interview people as they were coming out of the liquor store. Now, at that point, some smarter people, some of the looters, went around the back of the camera and unplugged it and cut off the feed to Fox. My point here, in case it's not clear, is that the media is promoting violence in these protests. That's what they cover. They'll put Chopper 2 up there for hours, but the footage we'll see will be 10 seconds of a kid turning over a gas can, or at one point I saw some people flip a car and then others flipped it back over, a police car. That's the kind of dramatic footage that our media thrives on. And it is a pronounced disservice at a time of unrest for the media to be in there among protesters looking for the most violent ones so they can put them on live national television. They have no sense of ethics or responsibility, and it shows all too often. Yesterday in Hong Kong, authorities cleared street barricades from the Mong Kok district. That's off Nathan Road there on the Kowloon Peninsula. 116 people were arrested. And they were picked up for unlawful assembly, assaulting or obstructing police. One man arrested for possessing offensive weapons, including an axe, hammer, and crowbar. 9 cops were hurt in the scuffles. And news accounts show that the protesters have set up new blockades and encampments nearby. What's really interesting is that yesterday, Hong Kong authorities also announced the arrest of 7 Hong Kong police officers. And you can call me stunned, because I am quite surprised that they are actually following through on arresting and investigating and charging the cops who were caught on a video camera beating up Ken Sang, a social worker and one of the nominal leaders of the protest movement there in Hong Kong. And I would never expect the Beijing government and its authoritarian puppets in Hong Kong to hold the cops accountable in this manner. And maybe they won't. Maybe this is just for show and they'll all be released and, you know, never actually be convicted. But I continue to be surprised at the manner in which the Beijing government and the lackeys in Hong Kong have responded to these protests. And I am still quite relieved that we have not seen a replay of Tiananmen Square. One of the protests, and I will offer some self-criticism, I should have been covering this sooner. But it's been going on now for almost a week in Mexico City. And I think it's a combination of factors. The trigger event is that 43 students were kidnapped and are presumed dead. And this is part of the drug war and the war on drug cartels being waged now for years by the central government of Mexico. And frankly, I don't know enough about the kidnapping and those specific cases to understand why, after thousands of people have been killed in these drug war confrontations, that this becomes a boiling point. But I'm certainly not upset to see the people of Mexico and Mexico City stand up and say, no mas. And now human rights groups are accusing the Mexican government of arbitrary detention, trumped up charges, and excessive force as they try to break up the demonstrations and essentially dissolve the protest movement. The complaint center on the indictment for attempted murder, criminal association, and rioting of 11 protesters who were arrested after masked use clashed with police in the central Zocalo Square following a huge and peaceful march through the Capitol on Thursday last week. Supporters of the 11 insist they had nothing to do with the violence, alleging that several of the detainees were arrested later during an aggressive police operation to disperse the crowd. And some of these prisoners who've been sent to remote prisons in Mexico was a way of making it more difficult for them to continue the protest. There's also a lot of outrage over the, I would say, obvious corruption of the president, Enrique Peña Nieto. And as you may know, his wife has come forward saying that it was her money that was used to pay for this luxury mansion that was actually built by a company that has a huge contract pending with the government of Mexico. And that obvious corruption, I think, is one of the reasons that these protests have become more potent. Activists in London, led by my friend the journalist Andy Worthington, have launched a new campaign to win the freedom of Shaker Amer, a British resident born in Saudi Arabia. He's been held at Guantanamo for 13 years now, and of course he hasn't been tried or charged, and of course he's been cleared for release for years by both the Bush process and the Obama process. He is the last Brit held in American custody at Guantanamo. And his profile is being raised by this new campaign. I spoke with Andy for an in-depth interview that'll be released to subscribers at Boiling Frogs Post during the Thanksgiving break. And he has won the support of Pink Floyd member Roger Waters and many others in the campaign to free Shaker Amer. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Andy Worthington.
You know, they have an absolutely standard response here, which is that they always claim that it's in the hands of the Americans. And that's patently untrue. I mean, I think it's slightly insulting for them to try and fob us off with that idea, because the relationship between the two countries is so strong that should it be important enough to David Cameron, and he rang up Barack Obama and said, listen, you know, I need one particularly big favor from you, it would be arranged. So, you know, but they brazenly do that to us. You know, what they've been doing recently, because they have been asking for his return since 2007, and they say that they, you know, at various times that they have, you know, directly requested that he be returned. David Cameron said he'd spoken to Obama about it, I think it was last year. You know, what happens now when people write to the Foreign Office is that they're now trying to get a little bit more subtle about it and say, you know, you say that he's been cleared for release, but actually he's been approved for transfer out of the prison, and those are actually different things. And, you know, I'm really fed up with this nonsense, actually, Peter, because, you know, either the US wants to carry on holding him or they don't. And, you know, all of the people who have been approved for transfer out of Guantanamo, mainly by the task force that President Obama set up in 2009, the Guantanamo Review Task Force, they have basically said, we don't want to carry on holding these people. So, you know, that is the bottom line with Shaker Amer.
You can hear the full interview with Andy Worthington. It's available for subscribers very soon, if not already, at boilingfrogspost.com. Also in Britain, a new report from Parliament is blaming an unnamed American internet company for failing to provide wall-to-wall surveillance over men who have been convicted of the murder of a 25-year-old British soldier. Now, you may remember this event. It was in May of 2013. And this soldier was off duty when two men ran him down with a car, attacked him with knives and a meat cleaver, just about hacked off his head. And it turns out they were both British Muslim converts of Nigerian descent. They've been sentenced to 45 years and, in the other case, a life term. But the British government is highly critical of this unnamed company's refusal to what they say is fully cooperate with the government surveillance agency GCHQ. Now, these two guys apparently had email accounts, multiple ones, and they actually discussed their plans to find and kill a British soldier in internet exchanges. And this unnamed company shut down a number of accounts linked to these two men. It says they had automatically suspended 4 of the 11 accounts before the murder because they had set off terrorism triggers. Now, what does that tell you? That tells you that our emails are being scanned for keywords. And the unnamed email provider here, it could have been Google or Yahoo, you pick your one. But they have systems that discovered triggers in the email communications, and they suspended 4 of their accounts. But GCHQ told the committee that the company had not flagged up the online exchange before the killing, and following the murder, refused to provide them with detailed explanation of the reasons behind all of the account closures. Now, because the company is unnamed and so much of this is really vague, it's hard to know exactly what's going on here. But my suspicion is that the British government is using this to soften up public opinion for more draconian legislation with further restrictions on the privacy rights of British citizens and expansive authorities for the government to intercept all communications. Police states are creeping on both sides of the Atlantic. I got a big chuckle out of this when I started reading online this morning and learned that Carly Fiorina has announced that she is actively exploring running for president as a Republican in 2016. And you may be saying, Carly who? Chloe's piping up right now. She says, Carly who? Carly who? Well, Carly Fiorina was the celebrated female chief executive officer of Hewlett-Packard who ran it into the ground. She was the one who orchestrated the failed merger with Compaq. And she was fired from Hewlett-Packard. From there, she decided to challenge Barbara Boxer for the U.S. Senate in 2010. And I had more than a passing interest because I did some work for a political action committee that was working to educate people about Carly Fiorina. So I had this bizarre encounter where she was speaking nearby at a community center that's open to the public, but the security to prevent her from facing the media or the public without a buffer and a bubble was incredibly tight. So I'm there with my little mini camera, and I'm staking out a side door of this community center, and out pops Carly Fiorina with a uniformed security guard right behind her. And so I roll the camera, and I walk up to her, and I say, can I ask you a few questions? And she said, no. And then she ducked into the ladies' room. And I do have standards, so I stood back and let her shake the dew off her lily. And when she emerged, the security guard immediately intercepted me and prevented me from any further contact with Her Highness. So Carly Fiorina is a loser. She still owes $500,000 to consultants. And one of the people she owes money to is a wacky guy who produced a 3 or 4 minute video attacking her primary opponent, Tom Campbell, by making him look like a sheep. They used a human who put on a sheep mask or whatever you call it, a sheep costume. And it was just frickin' bizarre. That's all I can tell you. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast. Monthly subscribers like Carl Harrison, Kevin Beckley, Jeff Gill, and Perry Productions. I don't know if that's a male or a female, but Perry, thank you very much. Just renewed their annual subscription for $50. And I'd like you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage. It takes you to options 5, 10, 20. $20 a month, whatever fits your budget, or the best deal is the $50 annual subscription. Next week, I'm going to unveil a new bonus gift for new annual subscribers. But while they last, I have a few CDs called Red Flag from our friend John Dist, and if you become a new annual subscriber and you're in the continental U.S., I will mail it to you pronto. Well, I'm not a big consumer, so it's not much sacrifice for me to promise not to go shopping on either Thanksgiving or Black Friday. Nevertheless, I will take that pledge. And one place that I definitely won't be going, because I never go there anyway and there isn't one near me, is Walmart. But for the third Black Friday in a row, Walmart is expecting to face labor protests at locations across the country. An organization which is affiliated with labor unions called Our Walmart showed up about 2 years ago. It demanded that Walmart pay all employees a base salary of at least $25,000 a year, but it's now shifted to demand $15 per hour. And I think it takes a lot of courage for a Walmart worker to refuse to show up and to picket a Walmart store. Because in some cases where unions got close to organizing, Walmart just shut down the entire store and walked away. And individuals have faced retaliation, even though it's illegal, for participating in organizing efforts. And I am looking at a story from Al Jazeera America about these planned protests and walkouts on Friday. And as good journalists, they contacted Walmart to get its side of the story. And spokesperson Corey Lundberg said that the employment policies that they have actually do a great deal to lift people out of poverty. Here's a quote. "We see people move off of public assistance relatively quickly when they come to work at Walmart because of the jobs and the opportunities to move up." What bullshit. What a big lie. Walmart's whole business model is based on and paying their workers such low wages that many of them require food stamps and public assistance, rental subsidies, and subsidized health care. Because working for Walmart extracts a very high cost from workers so that they can promise low prices to you and me. Brace yourselves, friends, for a Republican shitstorm, because the Obama administration is moving forward in the face of a Monday deadline to adopt new smog standards, particularly related to the release of ozone into the atmosphere. The EPA estimates that over the next 10 years, these stricter rules will cost industry about $4 billion. And if they tighten the standards further, the cost could go up to $15 billion. But the Obama team is using the lower standard, which will in fact have a lower cost. They're kind of conceding in advance to the right-wing nuts who are now empowered in the United States Senate. And Jimmy Inhofe of Oklahoma has vowed vigorous oversight of the proposal. Mitch McConnell, of course, and his Democratic opponent both ran against the war on coal and demonized the EPA in the recent Senate race in Kentucky. There's a great story that our friend Steve Horn has published at the Smog Blog today, and I'm linking to it in the show file for this podcast. He illustrates that while consumers like you and me are enjoying the lowest gas prices at the pump in, gosh, I don't know how long, but at least 5 years. Here in California, I filled up for $2.79 a gallon the other day. That's the least I've paid in as long as I can remember. One of the reasons that our pump prices are lower is that the cost of a barrel of crude oil has declined sharply. It's now at or below $80 a barrel. And that's a critical point for the frackers and other resource extractors whose capital-intensive drilling and extraction only works when they can get more than $80 a barrel. And Steve Horn, in his story, illustrates this by using the Tuscaloosa Marine Shale and quoting Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant. Bryant says that the Tuscaloosa operation has a little problem with the drop in oil prices. He said, it's very good at one point, it's helping a lot of people, but the other said that there's a part of me that goes, darn, I hate that oil's dropping. I hate that it's going down. I didn't say that out loud, but just to those in this room, my oil friends. And if the price goes below $60, then the fracking and tar sands extraction operations will be economically underwater. They'll be losing money for every barrel that they produce. And as Steve has been warning for some time now, the economics of the hyped up oil and gas industries in this country are built on very shaky projections. And Steve has shown that the more you frack a well, the more you have to frack it, and the more it costs. And that the actual output diminishes over time, sometimes much faster than the industry has projected to its Wall Street backers. So be prepared for belly-up frackers and other parts of the oil industry if this price drop continues. Another story of environmental concern. Here on the West Coast, we're seeing a sharp and expanding die-off of seabirds along the California coast. And the birds are called auklets, A-U-K-L-E-T-S, small seabirds whose breeding grounds include the Farallon Islands just off the coast of San Francisco. And while scientists are still collecting data, the largest concentration of dead birds appears to be in northern Oregon. Birds have been washing up in Washington State as well. And they believe that the warming of the Pacific Coast waters, and it's been up by 4 to 5 degrees over normal this fall, has led to a die-off of the krill. That's the food supply that the birds require. Now, it's not the first time. When we had warming trends back in 2005 and 2006, there was a large die-off of birds. But this time, we're seeing it in a more dramatic fashion, and other creatures, including whales, humpback and blue whales, that feed on the krill, have left the area earlier than their migration patterns usually lead them. So we'll keep an eye on this. Just another indicator of significant change, and that humans contribute to it. And finally today, a story we've been following this week about the adoption by the Netanyahu cabinet in Israel of an extreme national rights and citizenship law that would give Jews Uber status in Israel, and the current population of non-Jews, Arabs, who are some Christian and some Muslim, they'll be relegated to second-class citizenship. And this is another way of demonstrating that Israel is not really a democracy, but a theocracy operated for the benefit of people based on their religious and ethnic backgrounds. And into the fray comes the relatively recently elevated president of Israel. It's mostly a ceremonial post. But the new president, Reuven Rivlin, has been willing to speak up in remarkable ways. And this week he voiced his strong opposition to this proposed new law. And he said in an emotionally charged critique that those who have drawn up the declaration in their great wisdom, who had drawn up Israel's Declaration of Independence, said, in their great wisdom, they insisted that the Arab public in Israel not feel like the Jews felt in the diaspora. And if I can translate that, he's saying, we don't want to oppress minorities the way we were oppressed during the Holocaust. And Rivlin hasn't said this, but it always pains me to see the state of Israel use the tactics that Nazis applied to Jews in Poland, in Germany, in other countries in Europe during the Holocaust. And we see this big wall that's been put up. The requirements that Palestinians use substandard highways, they're subject to checkpoints when they travel between their own towns. I mean, it's a degrading experience to be a non-Jew in Israel or to be a Palestinian living in the West Bank or Gaza. And I think it's truly remarkable that the president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, actually seems to understand that and is willing to say so publicly in the, you know, hardline Zionist radical world of Israeli politics. He deserves our gratitude. And with that note, I say thanks to you for listening. Thanks for supporting my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. I hope you and yours have an excellent Thanksgiving. And we'll be back in action here on December 1st. I'll talk to you then. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until